please.
Okay. Thank you very much for this opportunity to give a talk, and I will really also try to give this tutorial in the beginning, not too long, but going. So these are the topics that I plan to talk. We'll see how fast it goes. So I start with sort of pairing physics, and my little tutorial on BCS theory and so on will be related to this. And then what I really will talk about is something that goes beyond the BCS physics. And then the second part of the talk is all kind of dynamical phenomena, dynamics in 1D systems. And these are the methods that have been used, but I will not talk about them very much, but rather on the physics. So, first...
DFT is the symmetric functional theory?
No, this is a dynamical mean field theory. It's a method that goes beyond mean field theory. But it's I will say a few words about it.
It has no actual dynamics.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's just energy, I mean, certain frequency dependent terms, and that's where the dynamics come, but it doesn't have dynamics. Yeah. Okay, so I start from this FFLO state, but I really go to the tutorial first. So, you know, superconductivity is important in many ways, and what I like in this, there are even superconducting power grids existing, I mean not in commercial use, but some 200 meters long lines, so that's our future. So it would be of course great to get, for instance, room temperature superconductors. So then what is superconductivity? So this is a what you learn in the grad school. So this is a material with atoms in a lattice-like form, and electrons are flowing here. And according to the BCS theory, there are lattice vibrations which help electrons that normally would repulse each other to feel an effective attraction. And they form so-called Cooper pairs. And this causes superconductivity. So they are called Cooper pairs, but pair is a funny name in this, this context, because it's not really what we would think about pairs of humans, that they are close to each other, or molecules that are close to each other. They are not on-site pairs. My analogy is this kind of thing. This would be like a university committee, and imagine that there is always, the situation is always so that people don't either don't say anything, or if this person says an opinion, there is always somebody who presents opposite opinion, like immediate, so either silence or opposing each other. So these are like a correlated behavior. And this is what is happening with the Cooper pairs. So in the system, you always have pairs of spin up and spin down electrons going to opposite directions, or you don't have any electrons on that momentum state. So this situation is mathematically described here. Here is the BCS wave function. So you multiply like over all possible k states, and for each k state, you either don't have any electrons. Oops, don't have a pocket. Or you have a pair of k and minus k for the different spins. And these are some factors that you can then calculate. And if you now look at, for instance, this vk, let's say vk is k squared, which happens to be the same as number of electrons in k state. Let's put here Kf. Here would be the Fermi level of non-interacting system. Here is 1. So it typically goes like this. asymptotically down here. So this means, let me put the Fermi level like here, that for low-lying momenta, not much is done. You have all the levels occupied, like non-interacting gas. But then around Fermi level, you will have this K and U non-zero, both of them non-zero. So you have sort of fluctuations of having the pairs and having nothing. So this is the BCS type of pairing corresponding to this situation. And now what has been done in ultra-gold gases is this BC-BCS crossover. So in solids we have electrons of spin up and spin down, but in ultra-gold gases we can have atoms in two hyperfine states. These are now the ups and downs, and they can interact via Fespach resonance, and then you can tune by magnetic field the Fespach resonance, and you can move from this situation up to this. So basically as a function of 1 over the Fermi momentum times the scattering length, you will see this crossover, and here is the zero point when the scattering length diverges. That's the so-called unitarity limit, where the only length scale in the problem then will be Kf. The scattering length doesn't matter anymore. And this type of thing was suggested to be a crossover by Leggett and Nozier and Smithrink a long time ago. But only now in ultra-cold gases it has been proven, that experimentally proven, that it's actually a crossover. Because you could also think that there is some maybe quantum phase transitions, that these are so different type of pairing, maybe there is a transition, but there is not. It's a crossover, and actually you can, if you want, you can show that this wave function also works in this limit. But I will not go into that. So in that sense, it's really a crossover. Okay, so I will not talk about this crossover today. Before going to further topics, one thing to remember here is that this, while this type of pairing, it happens for two particles also, this thing always requires this group. In other words, you always need to have a Fermi C in order to get this Cooper pairing. So it's a many-body effect. Yep. And as I said, it happens mostly around the Fermi surface. Okay, and since it...
Can I just add one point just for the general audience? So is everyone familiar with this? I just want to make sure that... Will the chemists and audience understand this? So you remember how in 3D, you can feel very shallow, if you have a sufficiently shallow square well, there is no balance state effect for two particle scattering. And so what the many-body problem does is it sort of changes the available phase space and allows a balance state to exist for an arbitrarily shallow, you know, square well potential, for example, in 3D, where you wouldn't normally get a balance state. So that's like very much a many-body effect. Without the rest of the particles, no balance state, add the particles, and you do get a balance state.
Yeah, and basically the reason is that since they are fermions, and these states here are occupied, you are restricting very much where you can scatter. You cannot scatter particle from here to there because it's already occupied. And this causes this thing that for really arbitrarily small attraction, you always have these Cooper pairs. And that's why have this crossover, that here, even if the interactions become really, really weak, you will always have the pairing. Of course, it's a very small effect, but it's there. Yeah, so, and since it's a many-body effect and dependent on the Fermi surface, then the shape and the type of the Fermi surface is very important for the phenomena. And this is very well known in For instance, in high TC superconductivity, where the materials are typically really complicated, and the Fermi surfaces also start to look really cumbersome, and this changes this Cooper pairing, and probably this complicatedness of the Fermi surfaces is behind high TC superconductivity. But as you know, it's still a theoretical puzzle to explain what is really going on in these materials. Okay, so then I go towards the actual topics that I will talk. So now in this traditional Cooper pairing BCS theory, it has been very important that there are sort of equal number of these up and down fermions. This is because the pairing happens at the Fermi surface, and the Fermi surfaces of both of these ups and downs should match. This is essential there. But of course, one can ask that, okay, if I don't have this condition valid, what happens? So imagine this example of the university committee, where you always have opposing opinions. So obviously this cannot decide anything. So you have like in the BCS theory, we have, if I look at this, this is the Hamiltonian, one might have kinetic energy in ultra-cold gases, some trapping energy, and this is the interaction term. So what one does in BCS theory is to say that, okay, let's do a mean field approximation, that in Dieter term we replace this quantity by a number, and this is called usually delta, and then one can solve it. And actually from this mean field type of thinking, one gets this ansatz and some values for u and v, and this turns out to be the pairing gap or the excitation gap. So there is a gap in the energy spectrum, and this is behind superconductivity, because then you need a finite gap to break this up-down pair. So there is a gap, and therefore superconductivity.
So the potential value is taken with two creation operators?
Yeah, this is a funny thing. Oh, sorry, this should be inside. So usually you think that, okay, this would be, for instance, density. Okay. But this is the particular feature of BCS theory, that you have sort of like, it's like expectation value for the pairing, like the pairing amplitude. Yeah. So that's really in the core of this whole mean field theory here. And it turns out to be the gap in the excitation spectrum.
This is why in the first line, in the variational form, she has a term without pair and with pair, in such a way that the bracket is non-zero.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay, so in my university analogy, you can think that there is like a decision gap, because no decisions can be made, because always one person opposes each other. So now imagine that the rector puts some external pressure on this committee that you should decide this way. So this would be like usually the densities are defined by chemical potential of the up and down spins. So now if you change the chemical potential of one component with respect to each other, this could be done by, for instance, imposing magnetic field on the material, superconducting material, because that would like to flip the spins in a certain direction. So what happens? Do I still have this gap and superconductivity or not? And in this case, do we get actually a majority because the rector expresses a wish? We'll see. Well, it turns out that there is so-called Santrasekhar-Clockston limit, which says that actually superconductivity can exist if this difference in chemical potentials is not is sort of smaller of the, or same order of magnitude as this pairing. So somehow that the gain from pairing is still bigger than the let's say the what the magnetic field would give the Siemens shift. And this actually has been also now observed in ultra-cold gases. So there, well, the number of ups and downs are conserved. So we have rather this kind of situation that we set a different number of this up and down particles. This would be correspond to the case that one of the people is ill. So do we still get superfluidity or not? Or do we get a decision now? Well, so this is actually the situation that we have in ultra-cold gases. But the ultra-cold gases are often in a trap geometry. So actually this trap potential acts a bit like chemical potential. So one can actually sort of see also this effect, even when overall it's the number of particles that is fixed. Okay, so people have asked these questions. What happens when we have magnetic field on superconductor, when we have unequal number of the ups and downs, or when we have different chemical potentials? And as I said, this Sandra-Sexar-Coxton limit has been predicted and actually observed in many contexts, not only in ultra-cold gases. But interestingly, there are also other proposals. For instance, so-called Fuldeferrer-Larkin-Ovchinnikov state, where they say that, well, even if you have unequal numbers of ups and downs, you might still have superfluidity if you allow your this gap order parameter to be spatially dependent. And now there is some Q here. And what is this Q? Well, in the BCS theory, it's k and minus k up and down that are pairing. But one could say that, okay, maybe I have k and minus k plus q that are pairing. And then make similar kind of theory and get something out. And what turns out? Yes, one gets this kind of spatially varying order parameters where Q appears. So Q is now like the center of mass momentum of the Cooper pair. And this kind of proposal has been made, but this is a very exotic state. It has not been yet properly observed in any context. There are some solid state experiments which claim to be that, okay, they are, let's say they are consistent with this state, but there is no clear proof. And this is one of the goals in ultra-cold gases, to actually observe this state. Okay, but this is not the only exotic state that has been proposed. There are other so-called polarized superfluid states, which have some fully paired parts and excess unpaired parts. And for instance, there was a proposal by Liu and Wilczek. They proposed a certain state. It was called, they called it bridge pair state. It turned out that in that context, I mean, let's say in 3D continuum and so on, it's an unstable state. But I will show you that such a concept can actually be a stable state in other places. So this is now what I will briefly talk about, and then continue to other type of exotic pairing. Okay, so there have been very famous experiments by there should be, this is wrong reference. I mean, there should be also science paper by Wolfgang Getteler's group, and these are from Randy Hewlett's group, and this is Christoph Salomon's group. They studied this spin imbalance Fermi gas in 3D elongated. So now one really has this condition of having difference of ups and downs. And they put it in the trap and see what happens. They can go down to the superfluid temperature, so it's an interesting question. And this is just to know, tell you that there has been these experiments. I will not talk about this particular experiment, just mention that there are then beyond mean field theories are needed to describe this. It was quite interesting because mean field results give wrong results. Okay. what I will tell about is this FFLO state, and especially in quasi 1D lattices. Now, this FFLO state is let's say a problematic state in the sense that it has been shown that it's usually a very narrow parameter space where it is stable, especially in three dimensions, it's very small area. Well, on the other hand, in 1D systems where there are exact solutions, one can show that FFLO always exists. But on the other hand, one 1D long range order is not possible, so one could not call it superfluid, and also the critical temperatures are very small. Actually, the critical temperature of a superfluidity is zero. So one can then ask that, okay, it's difficult in 3D continuum, it's difficult in 1D, but maybe in an intermediate dimensionality, there is an optimum. So there are,
yeah? Question about the transition from 1D to 3D here. Yeah. You simply mean that you take the confinement and you squeeze yes. down and you continually squeeze the confinement.
Yes.
And that's all you mean there.
Yeah. So this is what can be done in ultracold gases. You have your trap or lattice or whatever, and you tune the confinement one.
I mean, the Solenghi statement is the sort of typical, you know, thermodynamic statement that these systems are never really thermodynamic and never in thermodynamic limit. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's why this is really a sketch. This has been more like hand-waving argument that, okay, this...
And let me see if I understand correctly. If you... 3D would mean basically that KT, the thermal energy, is large compared to any confinement frequency. Mm-hmm. 1D would mean that KT is then small compared to two of your confinement frequencies.
Yeah.
Okay. And somewhere in between, KT gets to be... order of confinement frequency, even in the confined direction, but then you just keep making that confinement get tighter and tighter.
No, is it really KT or the Fermi energy?
Is it the Fermi energy?
Yeah, then you have to...
Yes, but KT, if she needs superfluidity, KT is much, much smaller than the Fermi energy. Mm.
Okay, so you're always in a regime of KT smaller than...
Yes, if you need superfluidity.
Yeah, at least, like, okay, around unitarity, very strong interaction, temperature can be of the order of.
Okay, so does it go 1D when the Fermi energy then gets to be smaller than the confinement? Or does that mean...
Yes, the confinement should be stronger than anything else.
It's stronger than anything else.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Fermi energy, that's the point.
Yes, okay. For Fermions, it's the Fermi energy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Last caveat here, she's talking about, for example, VCS theory and extensions of VCS theory, and those are all continuum-based theories. There's a separate pairing theory, which happens like, for example, an harmonic oscillator within harmonic oscillator shell. And there the criteria are quite different. So, you know, the critical temperature is very different. So just to say that there is a sort of small system version of these. She's trying to get the continuum analog in a finite system. correctly, is that right?
Yeah, well, actually, we do this in lattices, but I will show in detail what we do. So there are some mean field theories at zero temperature and so on who have proposed that, well, there should be this intermediate dimensionality that is good for FF law. And there is also an experiment by Randy Hewlett's group where he had this type of quasi 1D tubes made out of optical lattices, and he had fermions there imbalanced, and they looked at them, and the observations are sort of consistent with FFLO but don't show it sort of clearly or ambiguously. So that's also interesting in this regime. Right, so we studied this in this type of system where we have the actually now a lattice geometry. In all three dimensions we have lattice potential, and but then the hoppings are different. So along one chain they are typically, well, yeah, they are this T parallel, and here is T perp, and then we vary the ratio between this tunneling and this tunneling. So when these tunnelings are the same, we are in 3D limit, it's homogeneous in all directions, and then when this one is very, very small compared to this one, it's the 1D limit. So that's what we did in this 1D, 3D crossover. And we did dynamical mean field theory calculations, and I don't say at all what is this method, except that it goes beyond mean field. So it takes into account quantum fluctuations, local quantum fluctuations, let's say, around here fully. So we wanted to see the beyond mean field effects in this kind of system, and then we looked always unitary interactions. And this is the finite temperature phase diagram obtained by this method. So it's actually the first study of this problem that goes beyond mean field and in finite temperature. And the phase diagrams are like this. So this is inverse temperature. So here is going towards zero temperature. This is polarization. So polarization is just defined like the difference in the up and down particles. And now this T perp gives us how close we are to the 3D limit. This is close to 3D limit. This is close to close to 1D limit. And the phase diagrams, they do show FFLO areas. This is a polarized superfluid, something like this, that you, okay. So now I would have here a trap. So this is the profile in the trap. These are densities up, down, and this is the order parameter, this delta, this delta. So we can have this kind of polarized superfluid. That's possible in finite temperature. You have a superfluid order parameter, but different densities. So it's that thing. But the interesting FFLO area is also there. And in 1D, we have very special ones, because what is typical for 1D is that you can have this situation that you have in the middle of the trap, the FFLO state, and at the edges, you have a balanced superfluid. That's different in 3D. In 3D, it's never that way round. There, what you can have is a uniform order parameter in the middle and a FFLO in the edges. I don't have a picture of that, but that's the 3D behavior. So this is typically 1D behavior.
So if you plot this cross-dimensional picture, not with respect to polarization, but with respect to space, you see that the FFLO goes from the center to the border?
Yes, yes. I will come back to this because it has one interesting consequence. Okay. So what these results show, first of all, they confirm mean field theory predictions. There are predictions by our group and some others that FFLO area should be bigger in lattices. This is due to nesting of the Fermi surfaces. For those who know this topic, I can tell it quickly that if you have, let's say, square Fermi surfaces, then you can move this one here and you get a very big overlap. Instead, if they are spherical, the overlap is more. So for this reason, it's stabilized in lattices. And now this is a first confirmation of this thing beyond mean field and at finite temperature. Second thing, we found quite contrary to the claims based on mean field that this dimensionality actually does not play a strong role in stabilizing FFLO. If you look at it, it's even better in the 3D limit. So there is no, yeah, this speculation seems not to be true. Yeah?
For small T curve, do you see the transition temperature approaching zero?
Well, we cannot go to very, very small T, because this dynamical mean field theory is actually a method that is exact in infinite dimension. So going really to small dimension, I mean, going strictly 1D limit, we cannot expect it to be valid. So we stopped at this point. But yeah, it goes down. It goes down. But we cannot probe the, you know, that it would go all the way down to zero, because this method doesn't work in strict 1D limit. And even, I mean, there are DMRG studies and it doesn't go to zero even in the strict 1D. It goes smaller, but.
So what is the, your temperature units are dimensionless, is T and units of little t, or what's the temperature?
Yeah, it's in units of this T. Yeah. Yeah, so that was the second point. And the third point is this funny dimensionality effect that there is sort of a sweet spot in intermediate dimension where one can have extremely uniform order parameter, even in the trap. And this is now easy to understand. If you have like in 1D, you would have FFLO in the edges and flat, then something, how would I, like, yeah? So strong FFLO in the edge and not so much in the middle. And then in the 3D limit, it was more like these little things in the edges and bigger in the middle, or even could be flat in the middle. So going from this to this, you must cross a point where sort of both of them, the middle and the edges, are strong. And that is what is causing this thing, that one can get this very flat FFLO. And this is interesting because then we can have, even in the trap, something that looks like a homogeneous system result. And also for observing, if one wants to rely on some kind of technique that requires perfect periodicity, this is nice.
I mean, you said the lattice, but the site index runs from minus 100 to 100 there. Mm-hmm. So these are very long wavelength oscillations. The lattice is something convenient. I would call it discretization for your numerics. Mm-hmm. Still basically a continuing prediction, yes?
It depends on the feeling, yes.
What's the, well, yeah, it's, I mean, yeah. If you added more sites but kept held density the same, the filling factor would go down, but it would still be a perfectly good continuum limit. Have you looked into the continuum limit? So where you take the hopping to be large, the filling to be small, that limit explicitly? So nu j is constant, where nu is the filling, then goes to zero, j goes to infinity, or you call it zero.
Yeah, we did not look at that very much because, as I said, there is this that having a lattice helps to stabilize FFLO. So we tend to have fillings where the lattice effects are important. We could go due to continuum limit, but then all the critical temperatures and so on go down, so it's more difficult for us. We use quantum Monte Carlo.
Actually, the feeding factor in your calculations.
Here, whoa.
You showed us nice pictures.
Yes, one can read it from here. So 0.4, uh-huh. 0.3, something like this. So not really very dilute, close to half filling, but still reasonably away from half filling.
But excuse me, is it such that if you decrease the feeding factor and go to the continuum limit, the FFLO phase may disappear, or may disappear completely, or the phase space?
The phase space becomes smaller, at least here in the 3D limit. Okay, in 1D, there it should be there in the 1D sense.
But in 1D,
that
solutions people knew that tens of years ago.
So there it's, you know, the exact solution thing, but here in towards 3D it would go down.
I'm asking this question, I'm simply wondering whether there is a quantum transition such that if you have a sufficiently large feeding factor, there is an FFLO phase.
Uh-huh.
Then once you decrease the feeding factor, there is a quantum the transition corresponding to the disappearance of this phase.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, okay, this is something we could look at, actually. Yes.
This would be interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I think the answer is yes, you have another axis on this problem compared to the usual axis here for FFLO, and that axis has its related to filling factor, if you wish.
Mm-hmm.
As you go along that axis, since your region shrinks down, the FFLO existence region, you're sure to pass through a boundary. So I think there is clearly a quantum-based transition.
Well, sometimes maybe yes, sometimes maybe no, because people were predicting the FFLO phase in the continuum limit also, and Jorah Zichowski did a lot of calculations.
Yeah.
The point is that her existence region is much bigger than predicted, for example, in 3D, and so, you know, as it shrinks, as the film factor goes down and popping goes up, right, then you'll pass through the boundary along that line in the phase diagram. So if you think the phase diagram is having another axis related to the lattice, I mean, I would say yes, there has to be.
Yeah, we can look at it next thing. Okay.
When we increase the T-parameters, it seems to transition from the CFFO to the PSF. Is that a first order transition?
This one.
Yeah, I mean, when you increase T perv, it seems in the left figure you have a CFFO.
Yes.
But in the middle.
Whether it's a transition when I go from here to there.
Yeah.
This we cannot know. I mean, to get these phase diagrams, it's really heavy computationally. We cannot then scan this. I mean, we could, but yeah. So I don't know. We have only data for these T-perp values. Okay, so this was everything about this FFLO. I will speed up, because this was sort of just a briefly introduction to another topic, because we wanted to ask also that, well, so much rich physics comes out only by having different number of ups and downs. So what if I distort something else in the system, not just a number of ups and downs? And I thought that what if I put my ups and downs in different geometries? This has not been considered before. So there was this imbalance that I talked about. There are a couple of papers which have studied what happens if you have pairing between ups and downs so that they are in mixed dimensions, like one of them would live in 3D space and one in 1D. But these are a bit more like, just about bound states or something, at least one of the papers. Okay, and they are in continuum, just the dimension is different. So we have a recent paper where we ask this, that if we have mixed geometries, what happened? And this is motivated by what can be done in ultra-cold gases. So I have talked about the up and down, and typically they have been, for instance, two hyperfine states of lithium. But one which you could not probably confine spin dependently. But there are possible ways to create spin-dependent lattice potentials. So the examples are mostly for bosons so far as I know, but could be used probably for fermions. And furthermore, as you know, there are inter-species Feshbach resonances. So one could have lithium as up and potassium as down. And then they have a separate optical transition, so you could create optical potentials to them separately. So these things are emerging in ultra-cold gases, that you can really pick up two spins and have different geometries of lattices for them and still have them interacting with each other.
Polymolecules are a much better bet for having these different geometries, because the different rotational states see a very different strength of the optical potential, right?
Uh-huh. Okay, so that would be one more way of
a factor, a factor 2, mm-hmm. factor 5 in the mm-hmm. situation, right? So, and this is in some work with Michael, but I think it's better than trying to simultaneously trap it in the decimal.
Okay.
Once you have a molecule, which there you have a chill out, you just need two rotational states, it's already all demonstrated.
Okay, that's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah,
whatever, I believe there are many possibilities to realize this basic idea that you have one type of particle, other type of state or particle, and they can be trapped separately.
When you mentioned here in mixed geometries, mm-hmm. you are thinking one is in 2D, the other is in 3D, or you are thinking one is in one lattice, the other is in another lattice,
yeah.
And therefore my Fermi surface has different geometry.
Yeah, so the latter one, I will show you. So the really different geometry, not just these mixed dimensions which has been looked at before, but because so we want to find a lot of things there, but this was the example that we studied in our paper. So we assume that let's hope that somebody can have this kind of system where up particles see a honeycomb lattice and down particles would see the triangular lattice. So the down particles only move along these green spots, and the up ones move along all spots. So this is what we looked at. And of course one could have a multitude of other mixed geometries. And then we assumed contact interactions, so that when they meet at these common points, they interact. I mean, this is of course much more fun than when you take long-range interactions, because they don't need even be at the same lattice sites ever. And you can really have different parts for them. And indeed, the thing is that now you can have totally different Fermi surfaces, Fermi surface shapes for the two guys. Now it comes some equations. I run through them quickly, because those who know it can get it in second and the others don't need. So we did mean field theory for this system. The non-interacting system has the usual honeycomb branches, the two branches that you know from graphene and so on. Here is the Dirac point. And the triangular is like this. And they have the same Brillouin and so on, so that's convenient. Then we had this interaction, and we do the mean field approximation, this type of thing, assuming, okay, I'm not yet there. But anyway, if we have on-site interaction on one of the sites only, then this leads to momentum-dependent pairing. And we make this mean field ansatz and solve the theory. by doing a volume transformation, and we find the phases by minimizing the energy of the system. And just to show some basic things, in the honeycomb lattice, this would be the brilouin zone, and if you have very small number of particles, the Fermi surface would be more or less spherical. And then when you fill up, finally it becomes like this, that it's actually of different shape. So here is the gamma point and the K point. So the results are like this. First of all, we find three quasi-particle branches. This is because we had initially the graphene lattice or the honeycomb lattice, which has two non-interacting branches. So therefore, we have three quasi-particles. Here I can make a connection to BCS theory. So in BCS theory, you would have the quasi-particle energies are plus and minus, and you have usual kinetic energy term, chemical potential, and then this energy gap here. So you have two quasi-particle branches. And let's draw a figure here. K energy, so they would be like this. So here is the gap. This is 2 delta. So now we have three of these. And the phase diagram looks like this. And here is the upspin density, here is polarization. So we vary also the polarization here. And we found a new type of gapless superfluid state. I will show you soon what kind of state it is. But the interesting thing is that there are topological transitions here. So these now, these marks mean that here is one Fermi surface in this area, and it's gamma-centered. Here is one, but it's K-centered. And then there are areas with two Fermi surfaces. And now, whenever you go from an arrangement where you have different type of Fermi surfaces to another one, this is a quantum, this is so-called topological transition, because the topology of the Fermi surfaces changes. And we have even this kind of interesting thing that here these are second order transition and these are first order, so we have here a tricritical point. And these are also called Lipschitz transitions, these topological transitions. And
so sorry, could you explain what the forbidden regions are?
So
does that mean some kind of phase separation? Or what do you mean by
could be some, we just don't find a solution because our assumption for the order parameter was very simple. It was homogeneous.
Stripes could be anything.
Could
right?
be anything. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we don't know what is here.
Some kind of other structure.
Yeah. So we should have more complicated order parameter.
And then if this is a really rich and beautiful diagram. If you took a simpler problem of just having two spin states that saw the same geometry, but they just saw a different lattice strength, right? Then you would also get some kind of modified pairing, right? Because you'd have different Fermi surfaces, but it just wouldn't be as rich as this.
Yeah, it wouldn't be. I will come back to this, because really this existence of many Fermi surfaces depends on having this mixed geometry. But I can show you later. Okay, so here are how the Fermi surfaces look like. So this is the first brilouin zone. And always the blue lines are the Fermi surfaces. So one can have, for instance, gamma-centered and K-centered, or both of them K-centers. And here you can sort of imagine how these can merge and become like that. So here are all the possibilities that we have in the phase diagram. And we call this state incomplete pre-spare state, because it resembles the pre-spare state that was suggested by Liu and Wilczek, but was unstable in continuum. Here it is stable in this structure. So first of all, it's interesting that one can actually find it. But our is slightly different from that, because in the bridge pair state, what is typical is that if you look at the momentum distribution, you would have equal numbers of up and down for low momenta. This means like BCS type pairing here. And then there would be an area in a momentum where you have only ups in the bridge pair state. But ours is incomplete because we have also downs here. So we have areas where you have both pairing and excess fermions. And then one can see that, okay, in some cases we have two Fermi surfaces, this and this, and in other cases only one Fermi surface. So this is a totally novel type of imbalanced superfluid. And I mentioned that there are these topological transitions that you go from one Fermi surface type to another. So here it's good to mention that these are really non-trivial topological transitions, because you can also think that if I just fill more of my lattice, then at some point I go from this gamma-centered into k-centered. But this is not a phase transition, it's just triviality. But here, by tuning the density, we change the pairing conditions, and that changes the Fermi surface structure.
Is there a topological quantum number in one of the phases or not? Or just you change the symmetry of the Fermi surface, and that's what you call topological transition. There are no topological quantum states.
We have not looked at that. Well, there is a number, sort of like conserved number, is this difference of ups and downs.
Yes.
But otherwise we have not looked at like because topological defects and so on.
When you pronounce the topological phase transition, mm-hmm. it should be more or less said in this case that this is just a change in the symmetry of the Fermi.
Yes.
Because people may start thinking that there is a topological quantum state. Which is likely not to be true here, because the topological quantum state means that there are H states and there are H modes, which decay in the direction of the bulk and so on. But this is just a change in the symmetry of the Fermi.
Yes,
so.
Yes, that's right.
Question. Do you look at the FFO pairing in this system?
No, not yet. So it's maybe these forbidden areas could have something like FFLO type. I mean, we have imbalance, but we didn't put in any order parameter that is non-trivial and could have this FFLO type of thing. Okay, and then we varied also the energy offset between the sites, and we see that the area shrinks. And what that means when we put an offset is that we go away from this graphene type lattice into something that has a gap, so we separate the two branches. And from that we then know that actually it's the multiband pairing that is essential in bringing all these exotic effects. Because here, if you look at this, these are the dispersions of the non-interacting ups and downs, and this is what you get in the interacting system. So you really get pairing of these downs both with the lower and the upper branch. And this seems to be essential for this stability of the exotic pairing. And here you can also easily see why you get two Fermi surfaces sometimes gapped and so on. Okay, so now how many minutes? I can throw some. This pairing topic was done, but
20 minutes is good with questions.
Yeah, okay.
Try to finish before 2. So
well before 2. Okay, good. Because now I go to different type of things. So from now on, it's always a 1D system, and we look at dynamics. In 1D, there are first of all a lot of exact solutions for many body problems, and second, one can simulate dynamics more or less exactly. So this is this method, this DMRG that we are using. So the first topic here is related to an experiment that was done by Immanuel Bloch's group. That was done in two dimensions, but actually we can explain many features by the 1D simulations. So let me see. Okay, they considered this kind of a system, basically, but in 2D, where they have initially a band insulator, meaning the ups and downs are sitting both of them, so that all lattice sides are filled, and then this is empty. So they do it, of course, by having a harmonic trap that keeps this thing there. So they have that thing in two dimensions, like that. And then they switch off the harmonic trap so that the gas can expand freely. And they have interactions, which can be attractive or repulsive. And what they see, first of all, that for attractive and repulsive, they see the same result. This comes from the features of Hubbard model. But what they also see that the expansion is different for low interactions, it's more like this. And for high interactions, you have something in the middle that doesn't expand so much. And they call this core, and they plot the velocity that this core expands as function of U, the interaction, and it goes like this, and it has even negative velocities. So we wanted to look at this in one-dimensional lattice, so we do it, yeah?
In the paper of Immanuel, mm-hmm. They were studying this problem theoretically at the group of Hacking Rossius
yes.
Boltzmann type
yes.
equation, no?
Yeah.
And it was fitting pretty well with the experiment.
Yeah. It's a totally different type of theory. So it's Boltzmann equation, finite temperature, diffusion, and so on. Yeah, and it fits. But I will show that certain features can be derived by completely different arguments. So I'm not claiming that we can explain everything because ours is not finite temperature, so on, but certain things come out with much simpler arguments actually than what they are using. So, okay, so we simulate this system. We have initially this and then we let it expand at time zero, it starts to expand. And this is what we see. So these are up particles, they are initially here and they start expanding. This is lattice side. For small interactions, for large interactions looks different. So how to analyze this? Well, we look at the doublon density, so the probability of having both up and down at one side.
Yeah, that was okay.
Yep.
That's fine. I just looked really fast, but
yeah.
I'll put you on the next slide. I don't know how many sites you're working with.
Yeah. Okay. And here you see the up particles, and here you see doublons. So you can recognize that this in the middle is just doublons, and these are single particles. So what can we learn from that?
And sorry, just a little more about what you're
yep.
doing here. Use hard walls? What's going on at the edge? Do you have a harmonic trap? Is this uniform?
This is uniform, and we stop when, you know, these would bounce back. So they're hard walls, yeah. Okay, so then what we did, we simulated this and looked how fast does this core of doublons expand, like to connect to the experiment. And we see actually very similar behavior. I mean, even quantitatively, they have this, it goes down around U equals 5, same with us. And if we define the core in the way that they do, we see these negative velocities. So it's really very similar. And we asked, why is it so similar? Well, we did a sort of a study of this just by looking at these edge sites. So at the edge, you have one full side and an empty side. This is so-called Hubbard dimer. If you think about these two sides, you can solve it exactly. You know how it behaves. You know the dynamics, everything. For just this two double well with two particles. And there you can have singlets, or then you can have both particles at the same site, which we have initially. And we looked at like this, that what is the probability of having singlet sites? I mean singlets, well, it oscillates in this Hubbard dimer model, and we compared to numerics, looking at the singlet only, and yes, indeed, it oscillates at the last two sites. So you go from having both of them at the same time to singlet and back. And then we speculated that, okay, whenever you have this singlet, that they are in different sites, then one of them can kind of leak away. And then they come back and are a pair again, and so on. And well, first, just about this oscillation. This matches perfectly with the two-side model. The amplitude matches. The amplitude decay, where we assume this leaking of the singlets. And now we can have a look at these results again. And basically, we just explain it so that here you have this pair singlet oscillation, and whenever you have singlet, some particles can leak out. And then the pairs, they expand with the typical pair expansion velocity in the lattice. And that's it. And for small interactions, it doesn't work so well because these two fronts are not so easily separable. But for large interactions, it does. So therefore, we say that this basic dependence of this curve, this core expansion velocity, comes from this Hubbard dimer dynamics at the edges. And that's why it can be the same in two dimension. And
that's the fact that in order to evaporate, two particles have to become 1-1.
Yeah.
You don't have to become 1-1.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is why the Boltzmann gives it very, very well, so to say. So Kutzwiller and Minfield will give it.
Yeah, whatever. This can, you can use very simple arguments here to explain it.
Sorry, can you repeat why it goes down and then goes up? Because I don't remember that.
This.
Because with this simple model, I would expect that it just simply go down.
Why does the expansion go negative and then back up?
There is a bit of subtlety. It is because whenever you launch a particle from here, you also launch a hole in here. So it becomes a bit difficult to, how do you define your core now? This is a, so that's why we actually here is the expansion speed of the whole cloud, which is very well defined, and then the core is like this. If we look at now, which way is it? Only the Doblon, so I don't remember how it was, but the issue is that whether you take into account these holes that propagate inside or not. Because in some sense, these holes that propagate there, they are not the pairs anymore. But if you just take all the particles that are in this area, they are counted.
Is this because like the pole has a different shape?
Yeah. So therefore, if you just look at the number of particles in this area, it does not describe you the movement of the pairs only, because there are these holes. Okay, so then excited by this, it was so fun to see that you can see many things from simple expansion. We thought that, okay, if we have 1D system where we would have
I need to understand this. Because I think that if I understand correctly, what you say is that if I start to decrease, to increase U, so to say, mm-hmm. I have more difficulties to create one particle at the border. Right?
Yeah, and also the pairs expand slowly. Yeah.
Now, if I create one particle at the border, mm-hmm. then I create a hole, and this hole has a mobility, right? And
yeah.
Therefore, more particles can push to the border.
Yes, yes.
But why this makes my system expand faster? Because at some point I will reach the border again. The extra particle.
Yeah. Okay. It's like a fitting issue. This whole—it's somehow spurious. It looks like this slope that comes back up. It's just a fitting and definition issue. There may be some subtleties, but I don't think there's any deep physics in it.
Yeah, there is no physics. It's really about the.
I think the expansion speed of the whole cloud that tells you the whole story.
It goes
in some fashion. She couldn't remember exactly whether you're fitting the doublons or whatever. You know, you're going to have this sort of spurious effect. I don't think there's anything more than that.
Is it? I don't know.
Yeah. So the core was.
Do you fit with a or some? What do you fit with? What kind of function?
Yeah, well, it's more like looking at where. Yeah, and we use some kind of Gaussian looking how this front there expands, and then one gets this negative. But it's really. I think it's subtleties in the definition that actually one should not really define the core as something physical to look at. So what one could do, like in our sense, one could look at the expansion of pairs or expansion of these single particles or holes. Those are all well defined. But of course, experimentally, they cannot say, they just measure how this expands, and they don't take into account the holes and the.
What is exactly then the measure, the observable in this measurement? I mean, what do they really see? Just to make sure that I.
What they do is they take this middle area, which you see here, and fit a Gaussian there and see how it expands.
And then you should do the same.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, I mean, we did more or less the same, and that produces this thing. But what I say is that they. So in terms of understanding, it's not really the right thing to do. So this that it goes negative doesn't tell about the physics much. But one can think about it in this terms of having the pairs expanding and the holes going in. That what does that actually mean?
Let's let her
Finish. Yeah, maybe you know the. Yeah.
I'm not talking.
The holes always expand like ballistically, but the pairs expand slower. So maybe this brings it up this effect.
Let's hear about your FFL.
Yep. Oops. Yes. Okay. So now we assume that we have an FFL state in the beginning. So more ups and so on, and this. This is now the exact solution of the so-called FFLO state in one dimension. And it's in harmonic trap in the beginning, and then we let it expand, and we keep the interactions on during the expansion. This is actually motivated by this experiment, which was in continuum. We can do only lattice, but anyway, because Randy Hewlett said that for them it's a bit difficult to switch off the interaction during expansion. So I was asking, like, what? I mean, does one still see the FFLO correlations if the expansion is done with interactions on? And yeah, so we did that. And again, but basically what we see is two fronts, but now they are something different. So first of all, it's known for a long time that in 1D. In lattice and in continuum, you would get something like FFLO state, wiggles of the order parameter, and the densities of ups and downs. And you will have this FFLO momentum Q that was mentioned somewhere here, there. But now it's not like that the pairs are strictly at momentum q. It's more like just a feature in the momentum distribution that is rather flat. So it's quite hard to dig this out. It's just a small featuring. So therefore we also looked, okay, maybe in expansion one sees something. So here are again the doublons, how they expand. They start from the middle and they expand. And then the unpaired particles, so up minus the doublon, they expand like this. So two different fronts. And we can measure the expansion velocity again for both of them. And what we found out is that, well, both of them have some maximum velocity, which is related to maximum k that they can have, the unpaired and the doublons. And we found out that the maximum momentum for pairs is kf down, or for the doublons, and for the unpaired is q, this FFLO q. Now, this may look a bit funny in the beginning. So why do the unpaired particle have this momentum q? But this actually, one can show that it is like this. If you consider the Bethe ansatz in the large U limit, can you see this blackboard? So there one can show that the system will have two types of excitations. One would be something like now pairs in a quotation mark, because you should not think about some on-site pairs or anything. So pairs. And they fill up a Fermi C up to Kf down. So you can think, okay, it's kind of natural if I have a certain number of downs that in the large U limit all of them are paired with ups. So these sort of excitations that correspond to pairs, there will be this number of them up to Kf up. And then there are what one would say free excitations. And of course, if you have now Kf up and you use this many of them for the pairing, what you are left is this difference. I forgot to mention that this q, there is always the difference in the Fermi vectors of the up and down. So these guys will fill up to q. And therefore, so this is comes from the Bethe ansatz. And therefore, the unpaired particles have, they carry this momentum q. And one can simply see how fast do the free particles, the unpaired particles expand, and one gets q. So this is a very beautiful thing, because it's extremely simple. And here are the numerics. How they go as function of the imbalance. So they fulfill this relation very well. So this is how Q goes, and this is the what we see. So it really follows this thing. And then if we have some kind of unpaired, they would have of course constant velocity, and the same even in trap. So that's the point, that simply looking at these particles that expand at the edges gives up directly the FFLO vector of Q. And one does not get this from some kind of uncorrelated state, so where you have different numbers of ups and downs. And there was a paper, later paper, which did basically the same stuff but they looked at these FFLO correlations and shown that they are lost in the expansion. But we point out that the Q is still imprinted on these particles that expand freely at the edges.
Because in the original FFLO, the majority particles are living in the holes, so to say, of the order parameter. Therefore, they have the same, let's say, periodic structure, and therefore, when you expand it, you get this signal from the majority particles, right?
Yeah, one could think about it like that. I mean, in 1D, it's always a bit dangerous to have this.
But in 1D, but, the majority particles are also living in the holes, no?
Yeah, sort of. But look, it looks like this, so. It's a very tiny difference. I mean, this is the majority density, this is the minority density, so okay, you can say that maybe there are more of them in there. And if I, this, it's not drawn here, but if I draw the order parameter, it has just quite very small wiggles. So your argument is sort of okay, but it's to a very small extent. But it could be sort of related to the fact that we see this Q in the unpaired particles. Yeah. Okay. So I skipped the last topic. It was we did similar dynamical things, like having an impurity particle and kicking it, and compared it to Polaron in 2 and 3 dimensions. And we see one feature that is not there, some kind of feature in the dynamics that does not have an analogy in 2 and 3D. But my time is up. So here are the people. Thank you.
Okay, we have a few more minutes for more questions if there are more.
The guy in the right lower corner looks like Lincoln Carr. Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah, he did all this dynamics and then he went to consulting.
Ah, okay. It's my evil twin.
I'll raise a question. It's not something to answer now, but maybe for open discussion later. All this interesting pairing phenomena with atomic fermions. If you had polar molecules and their fermions, are there any interesting things then that the molecules can do for us? Or are, since they're polar molecules, if they make them bipolar, the bosons and fermions more or less the same because it's all long range? Or, you know, what, in other words, what can we do with the polar molecules?
Oh, many things. I mean, it's very rich. For instance, well, Sora and many others have worked here, have worked on this. You can get superfluids. You, if you have an attractive interaction, long range doesn't matter. It just makes it more interesting. So on. So, yeah, one can have many things.
I've been hearing the differences between bosons and fermions for polar molecules. So that's, you know, as I said, maybe that's for later discussion.
Mm.
Let's do it on Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. More questions?
Okay. Maybe the last question, because everybody is silent. People have discussed a number of times, well, actually many times, the structure of the FFLO space in 3D and 2D.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find various structures for FFLO in 3D and 2D, or you only were mostly focused on 1D?
Well, we went to the 3D limit in this study, yeah. But that's a lattice FFLO, and then so yeah, there we basically know what is happening. You get quite a large FFLO area because you are in a lattice, even in the 3D limit. But yeah, continuum we have not studied much.
What difference in structures are you referring to?
Do you
mean the
E to
the
IQX
versus cosine QX?
The thing is that what is FFLO? It's a sort of lattice structure. Like it's a super solid for fermions. Mm. It can be triangular lattice, it can be quadratic lattice. And people who study this quark superconductivity in high energy physics, for example, Krishna Rajgopal at MIT, he was speaking about 8 vectors in the lattice and so on. And not long time ago, people in superconductivity assumed an infinite number of lattice vectors, and then they also obtained a very nice FFLOs.
Yeah. So actually, in this this DMFT study that I saw, it's a real space version of DMFT. So it basically allows any structure. So it's like discretizing your space. And having so the FFLO vector is not put in by hand. It's just emerging.
Do you get out? Do you
well, the only
is it
sort of
simple?
Yeah, it's simple. Cubic, and the only sort of structure comes from the the trapping potential that it's a bit smaller here, and yeah, so something that is determined by the trapping potential comes out.
That just says the lattice is somehow pinning the structure, right? That should cause of her Hilbert vector and whatnot.
No, the lattice does not pin it, but the trap potential chooses a certain.
No, if you get simple cubic, you don't, for example, in 2D, you don't build a hexagonal lattice. You know, you would have just a square lattice, right? That sort of says your lattice is actually
That's true.
Lattice vectors are
that's true. Yes. Yes. And of course, in this when we had this hexagonal lattice, right, the order parameter follows that one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Another group coming in.
Yes.